My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Many of us have had the experience of a loved one share their thoughts as they approach transition. Some of what they share may be nostalgic, reminiscing about years gone by, or practical, concerning their wishes for final arrangements and unfinished business. Often, though, the words shared may be quite different from the way the person communicated before approaching the end, reflecting a marked change in spirituality and an almost etheric approach to the new journey they were about to embark on. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Lisa Smart, experienced this personally with her father during the last 3 weeks of his life, and it inspired her to establish the Final Words Project with world-renowned afterlife expert Dr. Raymond Moody. Lisa is a linguist, educator, and poet. She co-facilitates workshops about language and consciousness with Raymond Moody in universities, hospices, and conferences, and lives in the Georgia area. You can visit her online at finalwordsproject.org, and she shares this journey of discovery in her new book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. Please welcome Lisa Smart. Good evening, Lisa.
Good evening. Good to be here.
And good to have you with us, because I think this is a really important topic. A few weeks back, we had a gentleman by the name of Henry Fersko Weiss. I don't know if you know of him or his work.
No, tell me more.
But he is the gentleman who established the Death Doula Program several years ago, and now leads it here at the Open Center in New York, as well as other institutions. And one of the things that was emphasized was listening to those at the end stages of their life and listening and giving them the space to share whatever it is they have to share. And you take that listening one step further. So please share with our listeners your experience with your father in the last 3 weeks of his life. What was it about his last words that so fascinated you?
My father was a very rational, prided himself having a PhD and thinking very rationally about things. And he would have probably called himself a skeptic if you were to ask him. And in the final weeks of his life, the last three, he began to point to parts of the room and explain to me that there were angels with him in the room. Mm. 3 days before he died, he announced, "Enough, enough. The angels say enough. 3 days left." Mm. And indeed, 3 days later, he passed away. What also I heard in his language, I have a degree in linguistics and have always been very curious about the connection between the words we say and how it tracks our inner mind or how we're processing thoughts or experience. So the other thing I noticed about my father is that he went from speaking literally about things like, "Please give me a cup of water," to then speaking highly symbolically, almost as if he were living in a dream world and speaking to me from that dream world. He also began to speak what I call prepositional shift. He started using prepositions, you know, those little words that talk about where we are in space and time in very unique ways. So he started talking about, "Please help me get down," when he was lying in bed, almost motionless, but he seemed to be having the experience of moving up. He spoke in nonsensical ways, talking about his modality being broken, and in contradictory ways, such as, "Introductory offer, Lisa, the store is closing for foods and goods." And there were other unusual types of language. I guess the last one I'll mention is non-referential language, where he was referring to things, but it wasn't clear what the referent was, what it was he was referring to. So, for example, he explained to his secretary, who he was speaking to on the phone a couple days before he died, "Alice, this is very interesting. I've never done this before." And when I heard my dad say that, I wondered, what is this that he's talking about? Why doesn't he say dying is very interesting? Is there something else going on? And I noticed repeatedly in his language this non-referential, where he was referring to it's and this in ways that led me to believe there was some other kind of mystery going on that was unique or different than the shared world we were in together.
Now, many of us have been present when we've had friends or family in the process of transitioning and listening to what they have to say. But what prompted you to start transcribing his conversations? And what did you actually discover when you did that?
You know, I was trained as a linguist, and language and writing things down is sort of the first place I go to when I'm confused or scared or frightened. It's my sort of my safety valve. So as soon as I heard my father's language change, and it began about 3 weeks before he died, when he started making references to this big art exhibition that was taking place, and there was no art exhibition coming that we knew of, as soon as his language became mysterious and I knew he was probably going to be dying soon, I just pulled out a pencil and a piece of paper, and as I have learned to do with any language that is mysterious, any kind of foreign language or unusual language, I just started writing everything down, and it was my way of trying to make sense, first, of my own grief and this unintelligible experience of losing someone we love, but also of the language and the perceptions I began to hear from my father. Pen to pencil helped me track what I was witnessing, and then led to the development of the Final Words Project, because I became so curious and intrigued by what I discovered.
Now, for our listeners who are not familiar with the art and science of linguistics, explain a little bit as to how it works.
You know, many of us, if you think of science, we just see trees, we see rocks, we see grass, we see flowers. But through the lens of a scientist, there are ways of organizing those perceptions and what we see around us. In the same way, as a linguist, I was trained to look at language in a systematic way. And if I heard language that made me curious or didn't make sense to me or was unintelligible in any way, I would write it down. So, for example, if I heard Chinese but don't speak Chinese, I have tools for transcribing that language, then analyzing what are the verbs, what kinds of sounds, how do those patterns of sounds organize themselves, what kind of metaphors or ideas are relevant to that culture. So there are many ways of analyzing language, from the sounds to the meanings to the structure of the sentences. So with my father, the language that I heard from him at end of life wasn't quite like Chinese, but there were such an abundance of metaphors and nonsensical sentences and things that were different enough that I just sort of put on my linguistics hat, or the hat of a linguist, and just wrote everything down. And it wasn't until later that I more systematically began to analyze what I saw in my father's speech. And after I did that, I went to the linguistics library at Berkeley to see who else has looked at the language of the dying and analyzed it for the linguistic patterns and themes. And I found that there was really no one had done it. It had not been studied. We study the language of children, right? We know that there are certain sound sequences or certain concepts and certain syntactic structures that children will acquire at certain ages. We don't expect a baby to be born being able to to speak in complete sentences. But no one has really systematically studied the themes and patterns of end of life language to better understand some of the changes we see when people are dying.
I'm curious as to whether during end-of-life transition process, people either start malapropping using words that they believe has a certain meaning, but using it in the wrong context, and or sort of speak like Yoda, where they misplace the verbs?
Wonderful question. I think we see a little bit of everything, but the thing mostly is categorical. So what I found is that the structure of the sentences are in place. Everything, the grammar is in place, and this is still, my research is in the very early stages, so I may speak to you in a year and have new information. But from the data set that I have now, people seem to retain the grammar, but the categories change. So, for example, with my father, my modality is broken. You know, modalities usually don't break, from what we know, right? Modems break, other things that are close to it. So I think I need to look at more data to really figure out what kinds of categorical shifts we see, but we do see that the categories shift while the syntactic structure and the grammatical structure seems to be the same. But that's, we're very early in terms of deeply analyzing the language.
Absolutely fascinating. My guest this evening, Lisa Smart, she's the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And we'll be back with more of Lisa and this fascinating topic after these words from the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization. Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Miriam Knight of New Consciousness Review, inviting you to my new show where I interview the rising stars of the conscious awakening. We'll explore the many faces of consciousness in action and intriguing perspectives on life, the universe, and everything in between. Join us each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern on the Rising Stars Show.
Hey, America, we need to have a little talk. We've got more food than we know what to do with in this country, yet 17 million kids in America are struggling with hunger. Makes no sense. Luckily, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks has volunteers gathering excess food and getting it to hungry kids. They're kind of like food angels. Hey, become a food angel yourself by supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. We can't do it without your help. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Every Tuesday on Living with Moxie, join Shefali Burns and Donna Martouge in conversations designed to take you to the next level, where we highlight ideas, resources, and strategies that provide you with the leverage you require to meet and exceed your business and personal goals. Each week on Living with Moxie, we will lead conversations related to success, achievement, fulfillment, and extraordinary, vibrant living. Are you ready to live with Moxie? Join us.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Lisa Smart, author of the new book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. Lisa, your experience with your father's transition led you to collecting and analyzing hundreds of transcripts and accounts from healthcare providers, family, and friends of the dying. Were the people you studied mostly elderly or in hospice, or did they represent an age range from young to old?
They did represent an age range. There was a range. One of the primary people who shared data with me worked in children's hospice. So there were a fair amount of transcripts from children, a few from teens, and a large amount from people who are older, maybe over 50.
And did the age group have an effect? Were the younger people more prone to use different language than the elderly?
One of the things that surprised me, I would have expected a much greater difference, but I did not see as much of a difference as I had expected, because we're talking, well, primarily about language that becomes increasingly symbolic and some nonsensical language, right? And also discussion of unseen, you know, seeing things that the living do not see. And these are all things that are very much a part of a child's vocabulary and life experience, or a dying experience, I should say. So one of the things that separates adults from children is more sophisticated vocabulary, longer sentences, and so forth. And those are things that actually you do not find very commonly in the language of end of life. So children and adults, at least so far in the research, I did not see a really big difference in the language, and very similar patterns emerge for both at this point.
That's interesting. Would you say that the elderly actually have a simplified language, or those who are in that age group have a simplified language that makes it similar to the way that children would speak?
I would call it a more symbolic language. And one of the questions is, poetry simpler, right? You know, you make it something, if you look at a poem, the E.E. Cummings, "The rain has such small hands." On the surface, that's a very simple language, right? You know, the rain, I mean, in terms of vocabulary and structure, and yet it's symbolic and complicated in a way, right? Because of its symbolic meanings. So my answer is twofold. On one hand, yes, the language, I think, is more simple. We do not often see these very complex, you know, four-syllable words in the language of the dying. But you also see these really kind of complex and symbolic and almost poetic ideas, such as "my father's," you know, "the modality is broken." Those kinds of phrases that again have this contradictory nature and almost poetic nature are relatively common and on the surface may be simple, but also not.
My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, lived with me until her passing at age 95. Mm-hmm. And the day that she transitioned, my daughter, who was 11 or 12 at the time, had a sense that she wasn't feeling well and wanted to stay home from school that day. And she never did that. And I said, "Fine, you know, please do so." And she's sort of sensitive and psychic. But in any event, early that morning, my grandmother called her into the room and said, "Angel, come over here and hold my hand." She said, "Your uncle," which was my uncle, "was coming. He was in the room. That her husband, my grandfather, was in the room, and that they were all coming to take her home."
Oh.
And she said, "Kiss me, Angel. I'm going to leave now." And my daughter gave her a kiss. And then she closed her eyes with a wonderful smile on her face, and that was it. So she had seen my uncle and my grandfather and that experience of seeing those who had preceded her in transition coming to take her home or coming to welcome her. Is this something that's common in your experience?
The story you just shared is so classic. And when I started this research, I had no idea, because commonly, culturally, we don't know. We're just beginning to know how common this is. Dr. Christopher Kerr and his researchers in 2014 published a study of 500 people. And what they discovered is 72% of them had reported predeceased relatives and friends coming for them right before they passed away. And some people say the number is even higher. Matter of fact, I spoke to some hospice nurses a couple weeks ago, and one of the nurses raised her hand and said to me, "In our team, in our hospice, we do not even consider the vitals the primary indicator that death is approaching, you know, the vital signs. But for her and for her team, it's when people start speaking about unseen relatives or friends or religious figures sometimes in the room with them. And it's a startling fact to me, but this is in my data and is in the data of other researchers as well.
Now, that brings up an important point. Do cultural or religious background differences have a bearing on what's spoken?
From what I've heard, and yet this, again, this research is very early, there are not that many differences. I interviewed a nurse, this is more cultural or well, cultural difference, but a nurse who worked in Trinidad and here, but she said in Trinidad, when they speak of the dying and the nonsense that sometimes emerges in the dying, they call that traveling. Mm. They call that traveling, and they feel it's a sign that their loved ones are leaving or, you know, getting ready. They're traveling beyond this dimension or somewhere else. And cultural differences, I really want to, as I collect more data and in the months and years ahead, I want to look more closely at this. On first glance, no, I'm not seeing huge differences. There are subtle differences. Obviously, if you have a very strong belief in Jesus, you're going to maybe see Jesus or you might see angels. However, my father, who was a complete skeptic, saw angels in the room too. So he contradicted that comment in some ways by his words and his experience. But I'm sure we'll see more cultural differences. I did a book signing a couple weeks ago. I had one woman from Romania come up to me and another woman from the Philippines come up to me. And both of them looked at me and said, we can't believe it. Each of them told me of their own cultures. There's these metaphors of travel that emerge in the language of the dying, which we may speak about as we continue our conversation. But one of the things that's very common are discussions about trips coming or these visitations, as you had just described in your family. So there seems to be certain themes that are very common, and we may discover the universal, and that's what I hope I get to discover in the years ahead as we look at more cross-linguistic and cultural studies of final words. So, yes.
Fascinating that you say that. An aunt of mine transitioned about 20 years ago, and she had gone into a coma, but before going into the coma at the end, she told my cousin and her children that she was going to take a trip on a luxury liner. So here's an example of travel. And of course, if we look at classical literature, the Greek myths, we talk about getting on the boat and crossing the river Styx. So maybe this is something that is inherent in all cultures, this concept of travel or making that final voyage or journey.
Yes, that is something I'm inclined to believe. And again, the data will reveal more to us. But the journey is quintessentially a part of this idea of transitioning, and yes, it's so basic to what we know about death and dying universally. And if you look at the euphemisms in other languages, how people talk about death and dying, one of the common euphemisms in languages around the world is something about going to another place. So, yes. And, I'm looking very forward to the possibility of collecting data from around the world. As my book comes out and this conversation becomes more widespread, I hope we find out more in my lifetime.
Absolutely. And as your research develops and your next book comes from that research, we definitely have to have you back, because this is something to me that's absolutely fascinating. And I know that our listeners find it fascinating too. Just getting back to your dad for a second, what was his concept or description of angels prior to this experience and then as he was transitioning?
Prior to this experience, he would roll his eyes at the word angel. My father, again, was a PhD psychologist who believed that everything was a function of hallucination or the imagination. He believed very strongly in the idea of the unconscious mind. and he believed we had the great capacity to imagine things. And he would have said that angels were just a comforting hallucination. But at end of life, it seemed to him to be much more real and compelling than that.
Did he describe them to you?
No, and one of my biggest regrets, and as I was so shy as the daughter of a dying man, I had never been so close to someone who was dying, I was still so shy about asking questions. And now I wouldn't be, and it's one of my biggest regrets. I wish I had asked more.
May I ask what his religious background was?
We're Jewish. I'm Jewish. He's Jewish. But he used to call himself a gastronomical Jew. And he would say, you know, he didn't believe in anything. To him, Judaism was, you know, a corned beef on rye with slaw.
Cultural. We used to call it cultural Judaism cultural. In my family. Yeah. That's funny. My guest this week is Lisa Smart. She's the author of the new book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say As We're Nearing Death. Lisa, please share with our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and this amazing work.
Thank you. The book is available on all online outlets such as Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and my publisher, NewWorldLibrary.com. And people can find out more about this work at thefinalwordsproject.org. There's lots of information available for those who are curious.
And if people want to share their experiences, can they send them to you?
Yes. On the website itself, there's a tab that says share your story. Okay. And you can do it confidentially. And we're still collecting final word accounts, and we're very grateful for everyone we receive.
Wonderful. And we'll be back with more of Lisa Smart and Words at the Threshold after these words from the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at AscendingHearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
They say that car crashes happen in slow motion. The reality is that crashes happen fast. There's no time to think and no time to check if your child is in the right car seat. Car crashes are a leading killer of children 1 to 13. Are your kids in the right seat for their age and size? Don't think you know. Know you know. Get more info at safercar.gov/the right seat. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Lisa Smart, author of the new book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say As We're Nearing Death. Lisa, you've analyzed more than 1,500 end-of-life phrases. What trends or patterns have you found?
As I mentioned earlier, there's an increase in metaphoric speech, and such as, let me give you a few examples.
Sure.
people, well, you know, you had talked about the trip, the fancy cruise, or what was the exact phrase you used? The fancy cruise liner.
The luxury liner.
Luxury liner. So one of the things we find very commonly, as I mentioned earlier, was our metaphors associated with travel. People also often use metaphors associated or symbols associated with their life narrative, with who they are. So, for example, dancer and choreographer Jeffrey Holder said just before he died, he turned to his son and he said, arms 2-3, turn 2-3, swing 2-3, down 2-3. So seeing the signature metaphors in people's lives is not unusual. One woman told me, Carol emailed me, and she explained how her father, who was a roofing contractor, had an interesting experience as he was dying. She told me he would awaken and look over at me and smile so big. And he told me, they have all these kitchenettes over there. There were miles and miles of them, and he would help build all of them.
Wow.
So people begin to have often describe almost dreamlike visions or hallucinations, or speak the language that of the symbols associated with their lives. And many times when people speak of travel, they will use, again, vessels or forms of transportation that are dear to them. You know, here with the luxury liner, as you described, my father kept saying, get that oxygen tank ready for our big trip to Las Vegas. My dad was a gambler. So, of course, it was going to be the oxygen tank that had wheels and was going to take us to Las Vegas. And the other thing that we hear commonly are metaphors about a big event coming, a big golf game. People refer to that they're going to be the fourth in a threesome. And many times they will refer to friends or people who have died before them and that they need that person as a fourth. They'll talk about the big poker game, the big dinner. One person explained to me, my grandmother woke up in the middle of the night and started getting dressed in a long gown that was in the back of the closet. She was sitting at her dressing table putting on jewelry and makeup. An aide came in to see what was going on. My grandma said, why, I'm getting ready for the big dance. She then lay down on the bed and died.
Wow.
So many times people will hear their loved ones say, I want to get ready for the big dance. And they will say, there's no dance, Grandma. And oftentimes for the person, there is some kind of big event coming. And many times when we hear a pronouncement of some kind of big event, it may be a signal to us that death is close. So we see these metaphors and these symbols. We hear a much higher frequency of repetition. Many of us are familiar with Steve Jobs of Apple Computer's last words, which were, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. So the language we hear at end of life, there's much more repetition than we hear in ordinary living speech. And the language generally is more intensified, which I think makes sense because something very intense is going on, and language often reflects our experiences, right?
In addition to travel and preparing for a major event, what about people who have a very strong faith base? Do they have different things that they share or express?
I think so. I mean, for example, one of them, of the examples of a travel, is from my dental hygienist. And her grandmother said to her, yellow bus, filled with angels. Mm. So I think people do see things through the filter of their own cultural and religious experience. I was surprised I didn't see more of that in the final words transcripts that were shared with me. I would have thought or expected I might see more references to Jesus or other religious figures. And I was surprised that while I saw quite consistently references to people who died before us, whom we loved, or to trips and travel, there were fewer descriptions of religious figures than I would have seen. But that could also just be a relatively limited sample. We still have much more data to look at. So far, I didn't see as much as I would have thought I would have.
I was going to say, as your research continues, I'd be very interested to see, for example, if Christians see Jesus, if Buddhists see the Buddha,
yes,
if Muslims see Muhammad or some figure from the Islamic religion, and so on, and how different people's faith base or cultural backgrounds would affect the religious connotation of the messages they bring through. I think that'd be fascinating.
Yes, and I think... I would clearly expect that. And in the next phase of this research, I'm going to be much more attentive to those kinds of filters. For this first, I asked Raymond, how careful do we need to be and how disciplined do we need to be in collecting a whole lot of information? And because this was the first time this data had been collected, it was hard to get the data. And it really was. People had never really had, you know, in hospice so forth, people looked a little at me like, why do you want this? What is this for? And when I asked people to transcribe their loved one's final words, it was a hard thing for people to do in the beginning. And as the word got out, more people did it, it became easier. And I'm hoping as the book gets out there and this conversation takes place more openly and actively, we'll be able to start asking more questions about the data and analyzing it more carefully in terms of the kind of cultural and religious things you've mentioned.
Now, I know the majority of what your work is up to this date has been in English, but I think it would also
yes.
be fascinating if you started getting reports from other countries, other areas of the world, especially where there's still large indigenous populations who have very, very strange or different, not strange, but different cultures than we have here in the West. For example, Aboriginal people in Australia, or Native Americans, Indigenous Americans,
yes.
or people in countries in Africa, for example, where they still have very indigenous populations.
Yes. I spoke to someone just last night who's Lakota, and she described to me how in her culture, as soon as someone starts seeing seeing visions or knowing, she said oftentimes people can predict their own death. And as soon as they speak about it coming in a very predictive way, that then they have kind of a ceremony, a ritual, but they're very attuned to the language of their loved ones as they're passing. And when they hear certain kinds of words and certain cues, they know that death is being predicted. And then they have certain ritual and ceremony. And I said to her, oh, I want to talk to you more. And I will be speaking with her, for example, more. There's so much for us to learn. It's
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think this field that you've opened has endless possibilities. And I
yes.
think that the messages that you bring forward as your research and work continues in the future may bring a completely new picture to all of us as to what happens during the process of transition.
I hope so, because when I watched my father's language change, and as I've looked at the data we've collected so far, I felt as if language tracks so much. Language reveals so much about us. I mean, yes, there's a lot that language doesn't say about us, but there's a whole lot that language reveals. And as I listened to my father's words, for example, I could see that there was something going on with his consciousness. I mean, the description alone of the angels was something that was stunning and made me wonder what is going on. And let's say it is all imaginary. Let's just imagine that. Why is it that so many of us have the same kind of hallucinations at the end of life? Why? So just that alone I find really intriguing.
You know, I have to play, I guess, doctor's advocate, not devil's advocate, but doctor's advocate right now. Final words are often disregarded or attributed to the effects of medication,
yes.
Delirium, dementia. But according to your book, something else is going on. Please explain.
When I first, Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience in his book Life After Life in 1975, was a mentor for me in this project. I was very fortunate to work closely with him. And when I first began this, I said, Raymond, don't we have to control for medications if we're going to do this? And he said, no. And I said, are you sure? And what he explained to me is that when he did his near-death research, is that the same patterns emerge no matter the medications or the illnesses that people had. You know, so what it didn't matter. They still saw the same patterns. And I began to see the same thing with the final words work, that it didn't matter what meds, it didn't matter what the illnesses were, people were seeing, again, having visitations or talking about a trip. It seemed to happen no matter what was going on. I also, in terms of meds or illnesses, and when I talked to hospice nurses about this, because it was a concern of mine, many of them explained to me that there was a difference between the kinds of hallucinations people have with medications and the types that they have with what they would call visions, which they felt were very different. And there were several distinguishing characteristics that made hallucinations different than visions. Visions, when people had visions, they were able to be in two worlds at one time. So someone might say, could you please pass me a glass of water? I'm really thirsty because of the trip that I've been taking for the last half hour, right? They'd ask for the water, but then they would describe some trip. Let me give you some more examples here.
Why don't we hold that until the next segment? Because we're going to have to take a quick break right now.
Thank you.
Not a problem. My guest is Lisa Smart. Words at the threshold, what we say as we're nearing death. And we'll be back on this wonderful trip together on Olden Times Radio after these messages.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on OM Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that 4-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Lisa Smart. Her book is called Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. And before the break, you started describing some of the language that is used by people in transition. And they talk about something that happens in this world. And they're also talking about their experience of the next world. Please share some more examples.
One example came from Sharon, where her mother was in distress. For many people, of course, dying is scary and it's painful. And her mother was in distress and then turned to her daughter and said, "Oh, Earl is here." And that was her husband, who had passed away earlier. She said, "Earl is here." And suddenly she said, "Oh, I feel so much more comfort now." And she was talking to her daughter, and then she turned to Earl and spoke to him, and then turned back to her daughter. And one of the characteristics, the difference between the kinds of hallucinations people may have with medications and what hospice nurses described as visions, is oftentimes these visions have the effect of calming people, of giving people this deep sense of comfort, and also they're able to bounce back and forth between this world and what might be considered the unseen or the other world. And another example of this is one woman said to her son as she was dying, "Honey, could you give me a pencil and a piece of paper? I need to write down the invitation list for everyone coming to the party tonight." Mm. And of course he said, "There's no party tonight." And she wrote every name down, and it was of people who were no longer living. It was of the deceased.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful story. That's just, please, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, oh, and so it is a beautiful story. And it had that same quality of being able to move between the realms. And what hospice nurses tell me is that when someone is having hallucinations, oftentimes there's not that ability to go between lucid, kind of give me a pencil, please, and the unseen world. And oftentimes the meds, it's more uncomfortable. It's more, they're not the kinds of visions that bring comfort and ease to people. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the distinguishing things I had also heard about meds versus the visions we see. So again, this is a really, in many ways, a pilot research study. And it was Raymond Strong's recommendation. Let's see what patterns emerge across diagnoses, across medications. And those patterns that emerge, no matter what's going on, we can assume might be relatively universal, or at least for this data set, right? So we'll see as we do more research and control more in the future.
You mentioned Raymond Moody. You mentioned the near-death experience. Have you studied people who have had language prior to and then after the near-death experience?
Yes. I interviewed several people who had near-death experiences, and what was interesting to me, well, first, everyone who has a near-death experience describes it as ineffable. They all say, and Raymond talked about this in his first book, and I saw and heard the same thing, people say there's no words to describe what happened to me in my afterlife experience or during my near-death experience. People also describe that they need to resort to metaphor. The only way I could ever describe this is by giving you metaphors. It was like a big house with the lights going on, and suddenly I could see everything, right? People start using metaphors because there's no other way to describe it. People also talk about their near-death experiences in paradoxical ways. So they may say something like, "I never felt as alive as when I was dead." Mm. Or it felt like 2 minutes, but it also felt like an eternity. There are these paradoxical and contradictory descriptions of things. And some of those very same qualities appear in the language of the dying, being metaphorical, these strange, like my father saying, introductory offer, store is closing for foods and goods. That's a paradoxical or contradictory sentence, and there's a higher incidence of those kinds of paradoxical phrases in the language of the dying than in the living. And also those who come back from near-death experiences use an abundance of contradictory language when they try to explain their experiences. They also tell us that language on the other side is telepathic. People do not speak as we do through the voice and, you know, the apparatus of the voice. They speak mind to mind, heart to heart. And many people I've spoken to who worked with the dying and also family members and beloveds share that they felt almost that they were engaging. They had this almost telepathic communication with those who are at the end of life.
Fascinating. I'm just listening to what you're sharing and trying to take all of this in, and just totally fascinated by it. You had started sharing some of the final words of celebrities and people of renown. How about sharing some more?
Great. Let's see. Well, Bob Hope, who was obviously a comedian, responded to his wife's worried inquiries as he was approaching death. "Bob, we never planned for your burial, honey. Where do you want to be buried?" And with very dry wit, he responded, "Surprise me."
Fabulous. Who else?
Roger Ebert, who was known to be relatively skeptical, wrote a note to his wife as he was dying and said, "This is all an elaborate hoax." Comedian Sam Kinison, who died in a head-on collision. So it was not in a terminal illness, it was a head-on collision. Was talking to someone right after the accident, who no one saw, right, no one seen, and he said, "I don't want to die, I don't want to die." But then there was a pause, as if Kinison were listening to someone. Then he asked, "But why?" And after another pause, okay. And a friend who was with him said whatever voice was talking to him gave him an answer that relaxed him. And that's often or very frequently what we hear about from people's visitations when they see someone.
From your research, what does end-of-life speech say about human consciousness?
From my research, it says to me that there is a lot more going on than I certainly knew about or imagined, and that there is so much more to study. Some of the things that I learned through my research is something called terminal lucidity, where there may be someone who has been completely unresponsive, maybe in a coma for weeks, maybe even months, and we think that they are not with us in any way. And then suddenly, right before this person dies, and this happens again, this window of lucidity, terminal lucidity, of clarity, someone may emerge and say something like, "Tell everyone that I love them and that I'm okay." Another person described how in the very final moments before his mother died, who was unresponsive for weeks and had Alzheimer's for years, right before she died, she looked at him, came out of a coma, looked at him, and said, "All the files you need to settle my account, you know, to settle my state, are in the third drawer down in my study."
Yep.
How is it possible that someone who's completely unresponsive can suddenly emerge in this window of lucidity? So that was one thing that led me to think that there is more going on than we may imagine. The other thing, we know that when we are dreaming, our brains are as active as when we are in waking life, right? We know from REM sleep that the brain, this is, you know, scientific research, the brain is active. So in these states, when people are speaking at end of life, even if we were to say this highly symbolic language that they have and the dreams people have as well as the visions, the brain is being active, right?
Absolutely.
And how is that possible if the brain is dying? right? I mean, it just seems incomprehensible to me. And one other thing I'll share, there are many things that have led me to believe that consciousness survives in some way. People often who are at end of life, if you really transcribe and track what they say, have what I call sustained narratives. Someone may start a story on December 1st and say, well, the train's getting ready to leave the station, but not ready yet. Then December 3rd, oops, the train now is having some technical difficulties, but is getting smoother.
Sure.
December 10th. But over a two-week period may describe this story. And how is it that person remembers the sustained story over a period of weeks?
Absolutely.
What is that? Yes.
Absolutely. What has your work led you to conclude about the possibility of an afterlife?
It has led me to conclude that something is going on. Consciousness survives in some way, or at least we do not fully understand the dimensions that we occupy in a lifetime. Do you know what I mean? We just don't know enough yet. So I believe that there may be an afterlife, or there may be multiple dimensions. Most of all, I just know we don't know enough.
There is so much more for us to learn and share. And Lisa Smart, we absolutely have to have you back on again. Her book is called Words at the Threshold, What We Say As We're Nearing Death. Please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about this amazing work.
Thank you. My book is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, NewWorldLibrary.com. Also, you can find more information and a sample chapter on FinalWordsProject.org. And you can also submit any final words or accounts you have at that website as well.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and we definitely have to have you back in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a wonderful conversation.
And thank you all for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful evening.